This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from Queens College in the City University of New York. For more, visit theannexpodcast.com. How's it going, guys?
Oh, it's going. Going.
Yeah, this is a very 2016-2017 answer.
I wanted to kick off with something that I saw last Friday. I read on a post on Org Theory that reminded me of a really interesting and I think a really important discussion that was happening among sociologists earlier this summer. The blog talks about a tweet from Endicott College sociologist Josh McCabe, who tweeted a screenshot of then-candidate and now ASA President Mary Romero's campaign platform, which spoke of sociologists not being able to shield ourselves with false notions of objectivity, but rather to maintain an organization that embraces scholar activism. Do you guys remember seeing that?
Yeah.
Well, I was, yeah, I mean, if you go back to the original, I'm friends with Josh, and if you go back to the original tweet, you'll see that, like, all the replies are mine, just me, like, set me off.
It was huge. I couldn't stop myself either. It's something that I feel really strongly about, and we were talking about it on our department listserv. How do you guys feel about this notion of objectivity and activism in sociology?
Well, I'm going to jump in. So number one, you know, to her point, I actually think that there's something to be said for recognizing that, you know, even though like the vast majority of us in our work would actually like to at least strive for objectivity, understanding that, you know, whatever, it's like this sort of asymptotic relationship, right? You never actually quite get there, right? So as a discipline, when we come out and we claim that our research is totally 100% objective, I actually think is misleading, number one. Number two, you know, we had, you know, a divorce. I can't remember when it was, in the 50s or the 60s, when people decided to veer off of being part of ASA to start SSSP because they believed that, you know, sociology, right, as a discipline should actually be concerned with changing the world. And, you know, and that's why we have SSSP. At the same time, I don't think that we should have one organization where scholar activism is frowned down upon, right? And so everyone else who's engaged in that kind of work, you know, must go to SSSP. I'm a member of both because I believe in both approaches towards towards research, but I mean, that's my long answer.
It's not just that is objectivity strivable, it's also the way sort of the argument of objectivity has been used historically, right? So you think of structural functionalism, if you think of the loads of research on, I mean, in sociology and much more broadly in the social sciences, it's often been used, and especially all that research on culture, right? I think it's often been used in ways that create damage on certain marginalized communities. It's not just can we get there, it's the way the politics of objectivity is. And I think even if you just look in the history of statistics, we know that in the places where the argument of objectivity has been used, there's all kinds of biases that start from our assumptions that then sort of influence the way we think of what's objective or not.
So I kind of agree with Leslie with the first part, but disagree with the implication. So I hear and completely agree with what you're saying about nobody's ever completely objective, and objectivity is something we approach asymptotically. But just because you don't reach a limit doesn't mean you shouldn't strive for it. I mean, I view that as like saying I'm never going to drive completely safely, so I might as well just, you know, have a bottle of Jack Daniels in the driver's seat and, you know, swerve all over the road. And then I say, and you're like, why are you doing that? And it's like, well, I'm never going to drive perfectly. It's impossible to follow all the traffic laws. And it's like, yeah, but if you try, you'll get a lot closer than if you just say to hell with it. And then related to this, I view it, there's an interesting thing there in that I hear you guys saying, like, should we push against people who have kind of a praxis orientation. And, you know, and I think of it almost in the opposite way, in that should we view that as normative or somewhat compulsory or definitely as an organizational mission for the ASA, which ever since the Iraq War resolution, it increasingly has, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I draw a distinction between what I want the ASA as an institution to do and what I think individual scholars should do. And my basic bottom line is that I think individual scholars should be able to do what they want, although I certainly hope that they will draw a distinction between what they know kind of ex cathedra, speaking as an expert, and I think we should be somewhat humble in what we're saying, speaking ex cathedra, limited to things that we actually do know and not just opinions we happen to have. But I also think that people should be totally free to have whatever opinions they have, and if they kind of integrate that and their opinions are informed, or at least the implications of their opinions are informed by their expertise, then that's great. But I'm really uncomfortable with like the ASA actively pushing that and having this mentality of for every sparrow that falls, the ASA Council has to issue a resolution, which honestly, 90% of them don't reflect either the expert findings of the discipline or the professional interests of the discipline qua discipline, but just reflect the political opinions of the median member of the ASA.
Moreover, like I wonder when you start presenting the issue of objectivity as something that is unachievable or false, and I agree with Gabriel, it's something that you strive for, even if you can't fully obtain it. I feel like if you are not like the quest for objective knowledge leads us to improve and develop new types of perspectives. And if you are guided by a normative view from the beginning, well, then you might be pushed into a situation where you're ignoring new evidence or evidence that might disconfirm the ideas that you had going into a research. And it might actually squash our ability to develop new findings.
Well, so, you know, I'm going to jump in here because I actually think that I was the first one who said strive for objectivity. I do believe in the quest for objectivity. I question whether or not any of us are actually able to get there 100%. And so when some of us claim, right, we claim that our work is totally objective and we point fingers at other people and say, but not that one, right? I think we need to sort of pause for a second and think about the ways in which even those of us who actually say, I'm striving for objectivity here, we need to think about the ways in which, you know what, these are some of the ways in which sort of my sort of normative views may have creeped into here, whether it's in terms of how I decide to frame a question, how I decide to operationalize, you know, a variable, how I decide to actually like analyze my findings, right? At the same time, there are actually researchers who don't claim that level of objectivity, but I actually do think go into their field and actually strive, you know, to be as, you know, objective as possible in their observations, in their recording of the lives of the people and the places that they're observing, right? And for them to, and I think that they do come to conclusions that are at some level objective. If that person then decides to say, well, based on my conclusions, here's my normative view on what should be done about problem X, I actually don't see anything wrong with that.
Me either. I mean, I totally think, like I said, I distinguish between the expertise and then the implications drawn from the expertise. I'd like to see as much as possible people kind of be self-conscious about it and recognize when they're wearing one hat versus wearing the other. But, you know, your expertise can inform your policy implications or whatever.
Do you think that there are working sociologists who think that objective knowledge is achievable or that they're truly objective?
Yeah.
Really?
I do.
I actually think that, you know, Joe, you had mentioned that it's only in sort of the strive of objectivity that we can sort of lead to new findings and better science, but it's also in these very conversations of what is objectivity, being critical, breaking it down, sort of figuring out what our biases are. And I don't know. I just think that some of this is semantics, like what is objective, what is not. Like, is objective, is something that calls itself not objective rigorous? Is it unbiased? You know, can we trust all the other safeguards we have, like peer review, quality graduate training? No, but is some of this, are we tripping up over words? And is the incoming ASA president also just telling us, look, we have to open up this conversation, not use it as a shield, not use it as the end all be all, because historically there are a lot of problems with it. That's the way I read it.
Well, I would think in terms of my problem with this is that when you hear this type of Jack Daniels epistemology, which I'm going to call it here forward, of, you know,
making me want to drink.
Yeah. In the Titchener Annex, I remember you always preferred a whiskey sour.
Probably
some god awful well drink. Not, you know. Anyway, because it was like $2, so I don't think they were using it. So, you know, in this kind of Jack Daniels epistemology, there's this idea of like, oh, well, objectivity is unobtainable, and the people who are objective are really reflecting a point. And it's like, let's just go whole hog with adopting a particular point of view. And there's this assumption that from the people that you often hear this from, that essentially says, let's have an explicit orientation towards a emancipatory agenda. Like, let's have these strong ideas about essentially attacking inequality and adopt that viewpoint. And that is a viewpoint itself. Now, people who do that will sometimes recognize it's a viewpoint, but there's a little bit of a problem there in that there's such intense hegemony from that viewpoint that people can't see the extent to which it provides limits on the viewpoint of the discipline. And I think it does so in two ways. One way is that it diminishes the credibility of the discipline. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that if you ask God his opinion, so you have this totally omniscient viewpoint, God says, yeah, you know, everything Jeremy Corbyn says is, you know, absolutely right? I mean, he's the closest thing to me on earth. And so if you want that, let's say, for the sake of argument, that, like, Romero is totally right on the merits, right? She has the right viewpoint on everything. It's so far off from the viewpoints of the ordinary person that it diminishes the credibility of sociologists. And if we organize ourselves, basically, I feel like the ASA wants to make itself into the least effective pack in history. The second thing.
What are you talking about? I mean,
well,
I don't know. It just depends, you know, whose point of view you're talking about, like credibility in terms of who.
I'm saying credibility with Americans in general, right? I mean, so maybe if you basically turn sociology into salon.com with regressions, you know, that's going to like make us incredibly appealing to 10% of the population, right? And maybe it's 10% of the population who we especially sympathize with or we think are especially deserving people or really need, but it's going to make us incredibly appealing to them. But, you know, the other 90% of the population is going to say, you know, you're out in la-la land. And you're just not credible because you're so far off. And I think that has a certain amount of value, even if we assume for sake of argument that the view from salon.com is the correct view. Now, there's another sense in which I think it would be extremely unusual in like a probability sense if anyone's viewpoint happened to be right all the time. And I don't mean your viewpoint, my viewpoint, Romero's viewpoint. If anybody's viewpoint happened to be correct all the time, that would be odd. And so in that sense, I think it's a problem when you not only have a flight from the pursuit of objectivity, but you also have intense ideological hegemony. It ends up pushing you away from being open to things where occasionally people are right. The example I always go to is it took like 30 years between the Moynihan Report and McClanahan and Sandifer before sociology kind of was dragged kicking and screaming into the finding that actually dads help kids. And that is a viewpoint that would have been, I just have to believe that that's because of the composition of the discipline. And that if we had more of an even distribution of the discipline, now I'm not in favor of any kind of active measure to promote that, but I'm just saying thought experiment, if we imagine a less ideologically hegemony type question, type issue, then the discipline would have been more open to that in what turns out to look to have been the facts.
Well, I hear you, Gabe, but I don't know how I feel about that example that you give. I actually think the Moynihan Report didn't so much make people shy away from saying dads are good. I think what it did was it made people shy away from saying black families are pathological. And so they were like, you know, let's be very careful how we tread on how we discuss family structure and African Americans. And yeah, and I think you're right. I think that did actually cause people to back off, right? And, you know, and that's, you know, that's on us. That's on our discipline, right? But, you know, just calling you on that point.
But I think it's great because it proves her point in sort of inserting the objectivity issue at the very first, at the part of her, at the top of her candidate statement. At the very least, she sparked this really amazing conversation about what the future of the discipline is in these sort of new changing times. And I think, you know, at the very least, we should sort of reflect on that and the purpose of that.
I know. For me, I find it worrisome, though. Like, the idea, I understand that we can be scholar activists, but my worry is that when you have a major figure who is encouraging scholar activism, it might induce people, or it might validate the idea that we should begin with an agenda and then find the empirics that justify our agenda. And I think it's not a great path for young.
That's your perception. I mean, I think we've spoken most about sort of the objectivity part. The other part on the scholar activism, I mean, what, you know, that's your perception of what she's saying. But another interpretation is basically she's asking, what are we doing with our findings? How are we getting it out there? How are we building our careers on basically documenting a lot of us do, you know, social inequality, social suffering, and when, you know, what are we doing with the public aspect of it? And she's not the first one to have made sort of that argument. I guess perhaps one of the first ones to do so most recently was Michael Burraway with his whole public sociology campaign. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and, you know, and the other thing I'd add there is, like, I think another way to read this is, you know, sociology, stop, you know, looking down your nose at scholar activists, right? You know, the work that scholar activists are doing are, you know, that work is just as important as the work that those of us who are, you know, toiling, you know, in are, right? So.
But what if your a priori views are wrong in some factual sense? And we're all probably thinking about different topics. For me, I'm thinking about economic policy. Mm-hmm. And what if the discipline comes with a priori views that, for example, anything capitalism is going to be damaging to regular people, or that for a while globalization is a source of evil, and we push an agenda with a priori views, and maybe not, you know, instead of really trying to ask ourselves what pays off and what doesn't, and I don't know if we're doing society a benefit if we. If we stick with a position from the beginning, and we encourage people to do that, and I also don't know who's going to be the arbiter of facts. Like, if so,
that's how the scientific community. I don't think there's one person with an a priori view that sort of, I mean, on their own personal time. But we're conversation discipline. We write things. People sort of look at our data again. We've got peer review. No one's doing this sort of. It's not monolithic. It's a community of individual people that are coming in with their own training, with sort of, you know, their participation in the peer review process. Too.
And I also believe that, you know, any scholar activist worth his or her salt is actually, like, you know, their findings, right? Their research and the research of others actually helps to drive their activism, you know? So thinking that the way that it works is that, you know, a scholar activist comes at this with an idea that they just have about how the world should work, right? And then formulates a research agenda so that it gives them that answer and then goes out and tries to, like, enact that in the world. I mean, that would actually be, like, That would be counterproductive, right? We want to produce knowledge. Scholar activists want to produce knowledge that can actually affect change, and they want that knowledge, therefore, to be as good as possible so that they can then go out and try and enact change with that knowledge.
What if the change that they want is, for example, more deregulated access to guns? Or what about if the change that they want is... a stock conservative position.
Or, yeah,
well, I'm
so,
sure
but,
there's
or,
go ahead, Gabe.
Yeah, I was just going to say, this is a useful thought experiment, right? And that we're kind of assuming that the scholar activists at issue are going to be the kind of people we see at ASA who are saying, like, why aren't we talking more politically about the discipline? But it's like, you know, Chicago school-trained economists are also... can also be scholar activists in their own way.
Completely.
So, yeah. So it's kind of a useful thought experiment to say, do you feel the same way about that? Mark Regnerus is a scholar activist. How do you feel about him?
So here's my thing, right? Like I said, any good scholar activist is someone who's actually saying, you know, I'm trying to do the best research I can possibly do, right? To get at a social problem, to get at a social issue. And if this is what my findings tell me is actually going to be a really effective solution, then I'm going to go out there. And so, you know what? If you're a scholar who did the best, highest quality research you could possibly do, and your finding actually went out and like came out that actually we need more guns, right? I can't hate on you for that.
But
right?
How would you measure quality of scholarship without reference to objectively true or close to objective truth?
Yeah, and keep in mind that people have done experiments where they found that if you show people findings that they basically find convenient, and then you find them, and then you randomize it and you show them a similar finding that they find inconvenient, they will attack things like the sample size that are true in both cases, right? So people tend to be very nitpicky, even tendentious about stuff that they find ideologically inconvenient, and totally credulous about stuff that they find convenient.
Yeah, my whole thing is that, you know, none of us agree on anything, right? And that's part of what peer review is for. I mean, I don't know how I feel about peer review. That could be another episode, right? But, you know, as Christina said, this is part of a conversation, right? This is definitely part of a conversation. And we can pick apart one another's arguments. We can pick apart, you know, our methods, we can talk about our data, right? But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, if you make a solid argument, right, for your approach, for your methods, for the data that you're using, for your interpretation, if you can do that, and you can do that convincingly, I can't hate on you if you then take those findings.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. For more information, visit theannexpodcast.com. Music is by Lena Orsa. Our production team included Anika Chowdhury and Liseth Moreno. On behalf of The Annex team, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.